My pronouns are she and they. I'm zooming in from unceded Ohlone territory called Yamatush, otherwise known as San Francisco, or currently known as San Francisco. It's good to see you all. I actually would like us to do a little fellowship this morning. Maybe go on gallery view. And then I want to invite you to unmute and then say hello to people. It's kind of like if you're old enough to remember Hollywood Square, but without the misogyny. So it's like the rectangles. So just make sure you get the rectangles around you. And then I like to say, don't forget the bigger rectangle. So go to the other page or pages and say hi to people, even though if maybe they're not on. And take care, good care of yourself. And this might be a good time to come on just so we can see your beautiful faces. And then I want to invite you to actually use people's names when you say hi. You probably kind of have to anyway in this thing. But anyway, that's the idea. Does that work for people? All right, ready? Go. Just say hi to people. All right. And so before we go into meditation, I will say, and content warning, everyone. And I wanted to do it before meditation so that I'll offer something for perhaps for us to that hopefully will support you to settle. I'll say that there've been so many times that I'm really tired of giving talks about what to do in challenging times. So today I'm going to offer something that's a little lighter in framing of the teachings. And I woke up this morning to hear about another mass shooting in Texas, where 9 people are dead. And then, of course, with all the stuff in the United States around taking away access to women and our healthcare and reproductive healthcare in particular, and then all the anti-trans and queer legislation and that's going on top of lots of other anti-oppression stuff and so or oppression stuff. So yeah, just wanted to kind of put that out. All right, so I hope to offer you a meditation that's a little bit settling. So here we go. So we're going to meditate for roughly 30, I think around 25 today, because I have a pretty full Dharma talk to share with you. All right, so in my tradition, I do the bells 3 times to start and 1 to end, and I'll lead a little bit of meditation. All right, here we go. All right. Let's begin by arriving rather in the first foundation of mindfulness. The wording is to settle the, well, the Zen version is settle the self on the self, but essentially it's to abide in the body in the body. Right? So we settle into our actual body in terms of posture in the Zen tradition. That's where we first focus. In the insight tradition, the focus is on breath. The reason for that is both of those are with you till the moment you die, so you don't need anything else. And I like to say that the body is always present. So if you're aware of some aspect of the body, be it posture, breath, or anything else, then you are present. And so begin by finding a posture that supports alertness and ease. So in a way we practice to harmonize, I like to say, both making some effort to stay alert and the naturalness of the rest that we can find. So in any instruction or offering I give you. Just for instance, if I say, elongate your spine, either as you're sitting on a chair, a cushion, a bench, or lying down even, right? Or standing or walking, any position that's working for you right now in your meditative posture. Then if I say elongate, then what is it that your body experiences? Both your mind, your whole self, and rest in when the body knows the elongation, right? Instead of pushing past what is the body's experience. The breath is also helpful because if you, in my experience, when I say push past or collapse into something, then my breath actually is, I find myself holding my breath, or there's less of a flow. So they work together to give us a sense of what is it to harmonize how we know in body, heart, and mind. So begin by just relaxing, settling into a posture that feels supportive for you. Again, whether you're sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. All right, next I'll offer a meditation I call Settling Safely Home. So first begin, I'm hoping that you're in a physical place that you feel safe in this moment. And if you aren't, then of course it can be a visualization. And so first, if possible, and it works for you, then go ahead and open your eyes and turn your head left or right, and then just look slowly across the room and find one, two, three, however many that's comfortable, but doesn't have to be too many, just more a settling way. So what is it that you can make contact with that feels safe and connected? For instance, I see my black bookshelf. It's very sturdy, so it feels safe. I see a green plant that feels nourishing, so that feels safe. Even I see my curtains hanging so long and elongated, so that to me feels safe. Perhaps the ceiling or the ground also feels safe. So when you've made a round or two, that you feel this safety where you are. You visually saw it. Right? Now come back within the body. Check in perhaps by taking intentional few breaths if needed or if they arrive. Often when I pull myself in, a breath naturally wants to take a deep inhale, and to me it feels very natural for that sense. And also that I've connected to things that feel safe. There's a naturalness of a deep breath. By that I mean literally or figuratively, and then a settling as that exhale offers letting go, resting in safety as it is, good enough safety, well enough safety, right here and right now. To really feel it, so it's not just a concept. It really is a very visceral body, awareness of the body in safety. And now, I'd like you to scan your interior home for anything, any emotion or thought or sensation that's experienced internally, your internal experience. So you're going to scan perhaps from head to toe, perhaps within the spaciousness that you feel inside, however it is. And if it's difficult, just look for one thing, and if it's very difficult, then open your eyes. And again, just look at the physicalness. So if the interior at any point that feels difficult, then let yourself connect to the outside. Otherwise, you're scanning your interior home. Where is it that it feels safe? Again, at the end of my exhale, where I rested and felt the safety, I have an interior experience at the tip of my nose. That's how it came this time. It doesn't have to be any rational sense, but however you know it, let that be enough. That safety is safe enough. Perhaps as the chest expands, there's a sense of vastness or wideness as the chest expands. Or you hear an internal, let that be, a knowing of safety. Or perhaps you have a visualization of the tree at your grandmother's backyard, or the vastness of the ocean as you're laying in it and feel supported by the salt water. Whatever it is for you in this internal experience that gives you a sense of safety, let yourself feel held, loved, supported, that everything is okay right here and right now. You are safe, you're whole, you're complete. And so for the rest of the period, I want you to just connect and don't forget to rest in the knowing. Just let the knowing be enough, the knowing of safety. And at any point, the internal or the external, if you're doing that, feels too much, then you go to the other. Or if there is a intuitive need or want to move from one to the other, then allow yourself to know safety and not regulate safety. Does that make sense? Rest in the knowing. There's nothing to do. There might be a response to cultivate or reconnect to safety. And the invitation is to let the awareness of safety, for you to rest in that. Because so much of our lives, we're trying to find that or establish that or defend that. So let's see if in the next 10, 15 minutes, we can just rest in knowing safety and being safe. Allow yourself that. Again, it might take adjustment. If we're in and out, or maybe even a phrase, a metta, or whatever works for you. Maybe it's holding your hands together. You know, allow yourself whatever that is. Be safe. In the last couple of minutes of this formal meditation, once again, if it's useful for you, and if it isn't, there's no need to do it. And if it's useful to open your eyes and once again look around your physical environment, noticing and naming color or things, or perhaps as you're looking at the sky, noticing the vastness, or excuse me, the ceiling of the sky, or the ground, feeling the solidness. So just a real sense of settledness and safety. And then closing the eyes and noticing and scanning the interior for also right now, not 20 minutes ago when I invited you, but right now, where is there a sense of safety internally? Perhaps a posture point, what's called an anchor or breath point. I also like to call it your safe spot, right, where it's always really easy to connect to, it feels settling. And I like to connect it to that this is a safe experience in the heaviness of my body on the sitting bones, or the back of my throat with the inhale, and the vastness of the internal experience of my chest, my lungs, with a deep breath, or the belly, if that's where you're breathing into, or the way the shoulders drop with the exhale. Really connect your senses experience to safety, to protection, to wholeness, to completeness. Right. I hope people felt supported by that. Let's take a moment to feel free to move or stretch or whatever works for you. Just be nice to your body. Show safety, extending everywhere. All right, for those who perhaps came on a bit later, I was just saying I'm a little tired of giving talks about how to be with difficulties. I don't know, tire is the word, but and. I wanted to offer something today that on the surface might seem a little bit more light. Sorry, let me make a note for myself. So I'm speaking to my microphone. All right, let me try turning this up. Is that better? I'm hard of hearing too, so let's see. Okay, is that better then? Can you go like this, people? Because, okay, yeah. It's hard for me to look at chat when I'm talking. Though thank you, Eliana. I wasn't trying to say that, but all right, here we go. So recently I was meditating, or in Zen we say Zazen, and then I had a little surprise, it was rain. It rained. This talk is called Raining Zazen or Meditation. And I had a little verse that came to me around it. So first I'll read the verse and then say more about it. It's more reflection than a verse. I'm no poet. So again, in Zen, zazen is one word for one way to define zazen is meditation. Zazen is deep listening, I've been known to say. Practicing what I know to be true. A flash of light across the sky, sounds of drops. I don't believe my ears. Rain? Going to the window to look, nose pressed against the pane. Night is turning into day, so it's hard to see clearly. Needing to look deeply and carefully. Seeing the deck spotty with water drops, dry wood turning wet. Soon a slick deck. Wind swoops in, swaying treetops. Thinking, sudden storm. Amazement. Wonder, awe, stillness. Open the door or not, because there's a French door window. I asked myself, but I was afraid to let the water in. What if things get wet? Then opening the door, risking trust and faith. The smell of rain cannot be described. Waves after waves, life through the nostrils. Why don't I do it more? Of course, more correctly, why don't I know it this way more? I take deep, full breaths, deep breathing. Wonder, awe, stillness. Rain stops, mist rising from the trees. Mind ponders. Cold rain hitting hot ground, creating mist. No idea. Just wondering, not knowing. The mists like clouds on earth. Wonder, awe, stillness. A white heron flies by. Stillness. All right. That was my quasi poem reflection. Right. And I'll just go through them and then kind of talk about some Dharma points, hopefully, that connect, or some points of reflection and definitely Dharma points. Zazen is deep listening, I've been known to say, practicing what I know to be true. So I like those who practice with me have heard me say that zazen is like deep listening because we're with ourselves. We meditate for the most part, and many of us realize that there's a lot of dialogue. So part of practice is to really listen to that dialogue, and often it begins as just ideas, right? A lot of time about what we have read, about what practice is, what, the three marks of existence, if that's the talk, or, the Four Noble Truths, you're going, oh, what is that? What is that? Right? You're trying to make sense, and that's all right. And we listen to talks and podcasts or whatever. And yet, part of our practice is that kind of deeper listening of not just the information of what is being shared. Our practice is actually to know more what is, right? As Gil Fronsdal, one of my teachers, said, you know, it's like the Four Noble Truths, right? It's about dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, other translation, dis-ease, discontent, dissatisfaction. Our practice isn't to like go searching for dukkha. Dukkha is already present. We're practicing to know more clearly what is dukkha and what part of dukkha is created as opposed to that is part of life, right? What part of dukkha is it that we can do something about? That we can alleviate, that we can end. And you know, we do think about things and we need to. That's part of wisdom, is to hear and to study. And has to be more than just a knowing that, especially a knowing that of an I know. And not that that's wrong, because it is about practicing what I did say, you know, practicing what I know to be true. And that's the key, that we can't, it's not practicing what I know to be true as part of it. In fact, it is said that the Buddha said at the end, right, that turn the light inward, right, to really experience yourself and to know. This is one of the gifts that we can focus on around Buddhism, is that it's always fundamentally, right? The teachings are not to be grasped, the teaching are to be practiced, and therefore for each of us individually or collectively to know for ourselves what is true. And when we have that truth that we know viscerally and not just intellectually, then there is a sense that is a knowing that is very deep. And it gets to a point where you could say it's realization. And so, paradoxically, when we find and stick to a way of practice, it does become practicing what I know to be true. And what does it take? It does take desire, by the way. Sometimes there's a misunderstanding that desire is a bad thing in Buddhism. Desire itself is not a bad thing, it's the quality of desire, right? One way to define dukkha, or the creation of dukkha, actually the second noble truth, is that it's an obsessive, right? Tanha is the Pali word, and it literally means thirst. So it's a wanting that's like when you're so thirsty, you'd do anything for it, right? So it's that obsessive, and they can't let put it down. So it's the quality. So this is where, when we are practicing, okay, what is the dukkha that we can do something about, right? What is the quality of the obsessiveness? And so this is why non-attachment is considered one key to overcoming dukkha, right? Or renunciation. Is when it's obsessive, what is it to unobsess, right? And we know obsess, you know, sounds fun at first, but after a while, obsessiveness becomes painful, and that's when it becomes dukkha, right? So it's a quality of when does it become dukkha? These days, I like to say dukkha, and I'm no scholar, and this is not a direct translation. This is a Linism. It's, to me, dukkha is overwhelmed. When I'm overwhelmed, it's one is fills me, and I'm undone by it. So to me, that's when I'm dukkha. Right? So that's a way of, for me, of knowing dukkha. When it has gotten to the point in which, you know, like for instance, I stub my toe, it does physically hurt. That's dukkha, right? That's real in Buddhism. That's a real thing. Dukkha. And the dukkha that I can do something about is if I'm obsessed with, hey, who put that chair there? Right? Usually, of course, it's a little bit more. Who's the stupid person who put that chair there? By the way, I live by myself. Right? So, dukkha, I'm hurting myself. Right? So then that's the judgment, the pain is real, but the anger and the blaming is where I can see. I didn't have to have, right? Right? Or I'm so stupid. Why didn't I see that? Sometimes I lift my head and I bump something and I'm like, ah, so stupid. But no, it's just forgot to close the door or forgot the door, the cabinet door or whatever is there, right? And yet, how much of the time do we hurt ourselves, judge ourselves? Right? So, what does it take to practice? So, desire is a useful thing. Because the skillful desire to want to practice, that's a desire. And that's actually a very important desire in Buddhism. So there's classically called wholesome and unwholesome in a lot of Buddhist teachings. So wholesome desire is, say, we want to be compassionate and practice compassion. We want to learn how to meditate, right? We want to be kind. Does take material effort as means, as we all know. Takes effort, I've talked about that. Takes persistence, or Suzuki Roshi likes to say constancy. Effort that's diligent. Takes commitment. And it takes doing. Right? A while back, long while back, but I knew someone, I was meeting them and kind of getting to know them, and they say, oh, I used to, be a photographer. And I said, oh, you're a photographer. So she said, no, I'm not a photographer. You have to take pictures to be a photographer. And I haven't been doing it for a while, right? So doing, right? And I like to say in meditation, you can read a million books on meditation, but unless you do some meditation, you're not meditating. You can be mindful and you can have intention, but there is a certain craft to meditation. Not that that's bad or that you don't meditate, because there's lots of Buddhism that isn't about meditation, right? So I'm not saying you have to meditate, but I'm just saying if you're practicing meditation, you have to meditate, right? So, and part of meditation is developing and sustaining a quality, a practice that's useful. And one way is what I'm calling deep listening. Developing the ability to hear or have a non-rational only thinking and planning sense of how you're practicing. So does that mean a quality of curiosity? A quality of safety? Recently I was giving a talk, and so I'm doing this series in my Monday night group, Transcending, Uplifting Trans Buddhist Voices. And one of the readings, I can't pull up who it is because it is an impromptu example, of how they were talking about being callous, right, in the reading. And it just really connected me. Like, I've known that I'm an over-effort person for a long time now. And then it just really helped me connect that, oh, when I push through pain, this is being callous to myself. Right? So that was like a like, oh yeah, that's a du that's a over-efforting. Right? That's an idea of how I should meditate that I've imputed on too much, that I've become obsessive about, and my response is callous. Which is not kindness. A flash of light across the sky, sounds of drops. I don't believe my ears. Rain? Things do happen in life that we don't expect. And yet, so much of life is experienced through our six senses. And yet, when it happens, we question it. What? Really? Listen again. A flash of light across the sky. Sounds of rain drops. My ears heard, and yet I questioned. I don't believe my ears. Rain? Why? Most of us think it's because we don't believe. I don't believe my ears. Rain? On one level, the problem is we overbelieve. We overbelieve in past experience, right? We question what's going on right now because it doesn't compute with our ideas of how things should be, and yet how things is be to is how things are is through the six senses, right? And yet the idea of how it should be is already, you know, it's from a past, right? That's when an idea is. Most of us think our ideas are something in the future. You can think about the future. I'm not saying you can. But really, any idea you're having technically is present, but you're associating it to a past. Hmm? Or some association with the past. And so if we have a belief that we're imputing in the present, for instance, right? Like often in my meditation training 1.0, my beginning meditation course, someone, you know, almost always, people have a really hard time. They say, I'm not sure I can identify sensations. And to me, oftentimes when we identify sensation, we need to practice, and people don't have the vocabulary for that, or emotions. That's another really difficult area for many people. And so part of our practice is actually to really connect with our experience of what is, so that we learn to really trust what we know to be true. Now, in Buddhism, there are six sense doors, right? And they are eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. So these are called the six senses of Buddhism. And we live through the six senses. And how many out of six are sensation-based? Five! So the majority of our experience as this body, heart, and mind is through our eyes and seeing, our ear and hearing, our nose and smelling, our tongue tasting, our body and sensating or touching, and then our mind and thoughts. And yet we focus, and it's a very, you know, can be a very Euro-Western thing to really believe in the mind much more. Mm-hmm. Not that they're not true, or let me take that back. Not that there might not be validity in thoughts. It is, in fact, practicing to know what is true about our thoughts. And this is why the first foundation of mindfulness is awareness of the body in the body. Because how much of our life is in our body? 5/6. And yet we're taught pretty much not to ignore these and trust in this one more, right? I like to say Descartes, right? That's very Western. I think, therefore I am. I like to say in Buddhism, a thought is just a thought. And in a way, that's what we're practicing. To realize it's a thought that I don't have to believe in. All right? Thought I don't have to believe. And in fact, as oppressed people, we really have to start to source out which are thoughts that are unwholesome. Remember I said classically wholesome, unwholesome in Buddha speak. Right? And in fact, the Buddha said that he found two groups of thoughts that we tend to have. This is in the Eightfold Path and Skillful Thinking. And that we think of unwholesome ones as first is greed, ill will, and hatred, which can also be violence. The reason I'm doing them in order is because there's this the wholesome ones are the antidotes. For greed, we have renunciation, otherwise known as letting go. That's why you hear so much about letting go, right? Renouncing. So greed is also desire that's obsessive. That's what greed is. It does, right? Ill will, metta is the antidote. Cruelty or hatred or violence, compassion or karuna. Sorry, metta means kindness or loving kindness, Buddha in the translation and into English. Right? So these are considered the wholesome thoughts that are the antidote to the unwholesome thoughts. You could say positive to negative, useful to not useful. And so we actually practice to cultivate or access, I like to say, the wholesome ones. It's not like it's wrong to have unwholesome one, but and in Buddhism, we're not, mindfulness is not just like, oh, this is what it is, and that's all. I can't do anything about it. Mindfulness is awareness of what's here, but and part of skillful mindfulness is to be aware of when our thoughts are in the unwholesome or negative, and we want to practice towards connecting to or cultivating wholesome, positive thoughts. Right? And it's the same, we want to cultivate experiencing our life through our senses because they're part of us. And to clearly know, right? We also have thoughts about our senses. Right? And so we want to experience life. In some ways, when you hear teaching about things as they are, most of us think, oh, that's the thought I should be having, that's correct. They actually mean, what is it that you're experiencing? This is why so much of mindfulness practice in the first level is to understand viscerally what is happening. And it also works for trauma-based stuff, right? Like the meditation that I shared with you. Anyone who has had therapy around trauma will know that looking around the room and noting things in color is a good grounding, right? So it's a little bit of like this combo, and so it's useful practice. Doesn't make it psychological, though, the psychology in Buddhism. Just means that this is a real thing that we can be in the present. And use the mind to focus on something neutral at first, and then we connect safety to it. Like when I looked around and said, drape, my drape felt safe. I have never thought of my drape as safe before, but looking at it and thinking and cultivating safety, the length of it felt really like, oh yeah, that's a sense of safety, the length. How straight the line seemed as they're falling, right? That feels really safe. So now I've connected it. I'll tell you, I never look at my drape again without thinking, ah, that's possible safety right there. So it's really important to be able to discern and regulate and associate and cultivate our experience. Connecting to what is in a way that is wholesome, positive. That's part of practice. Can we just let ourselves experience life as it is? Going to the window with the French doors to look, nose pressed against the pane. Night is turning into day, so it's hard to see out clearly. Needing to look deeply and carefully. So, needing to look deeply and carefully, this is why constancy and diligence is so important in practice. So, fundamentally, our practice is to stay still, to pause, and to really examine. And when I say stay still, yes, there is a real physical staying still is can be useful. Because it helps us to notice subtlety. This is why staying still when you're meditating is emphasized. However, right, there also can be a stillness of mind and body that's not related to body, right? There's a stillness that you get if you've been on any retreat and concentration. The mind becomes subtle and still. And with it comes physical ease. So when we're talking about stillness in meditation, yes, it can be physical. But so remember, any instruction is that harmonizing. Where's stillness here? It can be stillness in my moving my hand. Like after a meditation, when I offered stretching, how many of you felt the stretching, even though it's movement, as a still kind of stretching? Right? Not a, you know, oh, I need to move kind of stretching. Because we had established, our mind had established a stillness. And so we carry that over. The body knows stillness. So in movement, there can be stillness. Because stillness also support us to observe, again, more and more subtly. So constancy, diligence. So really our practice, or where we're practicing, is really an endless practice. Sorry. Because what we're practicing in a way, and mindfulness in particular, the practice of mindfulness, really supports this. It's because in a way, when you start to practice, you realize that your life, our lives, are but one long observation. The word observation seems about I, but we're talking about eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, right? We keep observing what is it that's happening right here and right now. And this is how you start to realize that, you know, off the cushion or daily life practice, when practice becomes more embedded in your life, in a way it's one long observation. Oh, lifting, lifting, lifting. Right? Or, oh, anger, anger, anger. And then there's a moment in which the more and more you observe, there's a sense, and this is why the subtleness is important. By the way, subtleness, I pause because I don't want to give you an idea, and yet there is something to it, right? Which when we're much clearer about mindfulness, as in really observing moment to moment, there's actually a sense of spaciousness. So you could go, oh, there's a judgmental thought. Do I need to voice it? Do I need to believe it? And with enough of that, then you start to go, no, don't need to. And then letting go happens on its own. Or you decide, oh, let's attend to the stubbing toe, not the thought of why is that, what did I use, chair or couch or whatever was there. Let's rub it. And then, by the way, that's another sensation, right? To alleviate the pain, we rub it. So there's more body experience going on here to alleviate suffering. We think, oh, I just need to think differently to suffer less. How many people really? Come on. How many of you think, right? I certainly thought, okay, I got to have the right thought, right? I got to read. You know, have affirmating thought, and that's why, you know, not that those things are not useful, mind you. I've done plenty of those, and they're useful. Memorizing Brahma Vihara phrases, definitely. Not that they're not useful. And again, we're over-dependent upon changing our life through our thoughts. Again, useful, useful, useful. And a lot of training is about shifting the way we frame things, so without a doubt. And what would it be to settle into the body, to know what you know as true? Seeing the deck's body with water, dry wood turning wet. Soon a slick deck, wind swoops in, swaying treetops, thinking, sudden storm. Amazement. Wonder, awe, stillness. Suzuki Roshi, in his book called Not Always So, in a chapter called Pure Silk, Sharp Iron. He says, unless you train yourself through hard practice, you will have no eyes to see and no feeling to appreciate something that is truly good. Only when many people have the eyes to see or to feel something good will we have good teachers and students. This is mutual practice. Buddha was great because people were great. When people are not ready, there will be no Buddha. I don't expect every one of you to become a great teacher, but we must have eyes to see what is good and what is not good. This mind will be acquired by practice. In Zen, we don't very specifically say things about, all those lists in Buddhism, but basically it says, right? Skillful or wise thinking. That supports us. Open the door or not, I ask myself, afraid to let water in. What if things get wet? Then opening the door, risking trust and faith. So we practice not to fix ourselves or our bad habits. We're not really practicing necessary to change the thoughts we have. Yes, we can cultivate different thoughts and then certain kinds of thoughts naturally fall away. But if we only come in to fix things, then the problem is that when things don't fix on our timeline or in the way we think, then we could suffer more. And this is where the non-gaining mind comes in to help, right? And this is what we're talking about. Not that it isn't useful to cultivate positive, wholesome thoughts. I just went through that, right? And what we want to do is not to believe in unwholesome, for instance, internalized phobias, right? Homophobias or gender phobia or race phobia, right? Internalized thoughts. Open the door or not, I ask myself, afraid to let water in. What if things get wet? Then open the door, risking trust and faith. So we do want to practice to know our habitual tendencies. Doubt. Those lines were about doubt, right? One of the hindrances. And also not that internalize of doubting ourselves that comes with being oppressed. And then we also want to practice to be with them in a way that supports us to keep on interacting with life, right? Even our internalized racism, how do we approach it in a friendly manner? We're not here to crush them. We're here to say, oh, I don't have to believe that thought. Oh, what is the impact of that thought on my body? It makes me tight, makes me feel small, makes my heart heavy. And so I see the impact if I keep believing in that thought. So let's practice when they come up to attend to going, hey, it's okay. It doesn't have to be you. It isn't about you. It's ignorance. It's delusion that's on others. Really to attend to this aching heart. I feel like so much of our practice in anti-oppression is really to attend to ourselves. I started out writing my book about, or even the courses about like systemic, how to deal with it with a activist background, and then I realized, we have to heal the impact. When we're in the down power position of any oppression, we need to spend more time in healing ourselves. If we're in the up power position of an oppression, then our role is to take care of the structure. if your job is to take care of the structure, then all the more you have to take care of yourself. Or most of your life is to deal with the structure. And so, how is it that we practice to know our habitual tendency to have a more kind response as we cultivate more wholesome, skillful ones? Because what we want to do is we want to be with ourselves in a way that helps us to keep on interacting with life, not to be overwhelmed by life, internally or externally, so that we can open up. That's what risk taking is, right? How do I stay open? How do I keep on meeting life from a sense of safety and protection, knowing that it's present? Doesn't mean that it isn't always present, but even when things are not safe, is there a way that I know that the safety that's here is always here? So that I can take risks. Right? And that comes with practice. And practice, you know, again, it's called practice for a reason, is we start to develop more trust and faith. Like in the meditation I offered. That's a practice so you have more trust and faith in knowing safety for yourself that you can always connect to. So that can be taken away from you. And by the way, recently I think of faith as strength and confidence. Trust and faith as strength and confidence. I become more confident in what I know to be true for me. Or my community, and/or the smell of rain cannot be described. Wave after waves, life through the nostrils. Why don't I do it more? Of course, more correctly, why don't I know it this way more? It's not like my nose didn't smell the rain on its own, right? Right? It's that questioning of our experience that's so embedded in systems of oppression. So, how do we, one way to meet life more is to take deep, full breaths. Waves after waves, life through the nostrils. How many of you today or any day thought, oh yeah, I'm living my life through my nostrils? Unless it's like, ugh, I don't want that smell. Right. I live in San Francisco. Ugh, I don't want that smell. It's a large part of my life, right? My day-to-day life. But what if we go, oh yeah, this is life. Right? It's not like it didn't already come through the nostrils, by the way. So it's how do we meet it? Take deep, full breaths. More deep breathing or deep listening. How many times when we do that, we have wonder and awe, right? You go hiking, or when I go hiking, get to that spot and you look around and you take deep breaths, or the deep breaths come with the fully seeing of the wondrousness of what's here. What if we did that with each other? Oh, I should have done it in the beginning. Maybe our exit will be we all look at each other with wonder and awe. And with that brings stillness. See, the stillness is not just a body stillness. It's the knowing that's deep and true and connecting. Well, that's my definition right now. Of course, the question is, why don't I let myself know this more? Why don't I experience life as it is, beyond my thoughts of how things should be, beyond how we conceptualize things as they arise. Suzuki Roshi, in the same chapter here, Pure Silk, Sharp Iron, says, yesterday a visitor, Japanese visitor was speaking about Japanese literature. Japanese people have been studying Chinese characters and Chinese culture since about 600 or 700 AD. And after using Chinese characters, they established their own way of writing. The same thing will happen here with our practice. 100 years after the Japanese government stopped sending students to China to study Chinese culture, we had an exquisite Japanese culture. In the Fujiwara period, especially, we had beautiful Japanese literature and calligraphy. There was a lot of freedom. Artists and scholars study the arts, philosophy, and religion. They try various disciplines, and they had good teachers. Later it says, through long practice and training, we get rid of ego. A word in Japanese that expresses this training is niru. Niru is how we refine silk by washing it many times so that the threads are white and soft enough to weave. We also use the character for iron. We temper iron by hitting it while it's hot, not to forge or to shape, but to make it strong. Hitting it after it is cold doesn't work. Training is something like this. When you are young, you have a lot of ego, a lot of desires. Through training, you rub and wash your ego, and you become quite soft, like pure white silk. Even though you have strong desires, if you temper them enough, you will have strong, sharp iron, like a Japanese sword. This is how we train ourselves. This is not something for me to talk about, but something I must show you by my everyday life, which is not so good. I am afraid you will study only my weak points. We should know why we practice Zazen, and we should be able to tell the difference between something that is good and something that just looks good. There is a big difference. All right, rain stops. Mist rising from the trees. The mind ponders. Cold rain hitting hot ground. Creating mist? No idea. Just wondering. Not knowing. Like clouds on earth. Wonder. Awe. Stillness. So Suzuki Roshi continues. Unless you train yourself through hard practice, you will not have... Oh, I already read that part. I apologize. I'm going to here. Even in the Fujiwara period, Chinese culture and calligraphy were far superior to Japanese. The Chinese people had various brushes and always used the brush more than Japanese people did. The Japanese had fewer materials to make brushes. We had lots of bamboo, but few sheep or animals from which to make brushes. So our training in calligraphy was more limited than that of Chinese peoples. But even before Japanese people mastered Chinese calligraphy completely, they had already started a unique Japanese calligraphy. I find this very interesting. Historically, Buddhists have been very sincere about this point. This is why we have Dharma transmission, when a teacher empowers a student to become a teacher and to give the precepts. Chinese masters, they're sincere about this point. That is why we have Dharma transmission. Chinese masters especially put strong emphasis on transmission. It is necessary to master the teacher's way completely before you are free from it. This is very hard practice. That is why it takes such a long time to be a Zen master. It is not knowledge. It is not some power. The point is whether a person is trained enough to be like pure silk and very sharp iron. At that time, without trying to do anything, you will be able to express your personality in its true sense. We cannot see any true person, excuse me, if we cannot see any true personality in a person's work It means that he or she or they has not been, not yet eliminated their habitual way. So the irony of practice is that, in Zen at least, is that you actually become more yourself, right? How do we become more ourselves, right? This is why we settle the self on the self. Our category, which is that to settle the self on the self and let your life force bloom. Rain brings growth, by the way. So how do we practice to appreciate ourselves, to connect with our sense of self, right? To be anti-oppression is to actually, in my sense, is to heal the impact of the harm and to keep living from the sense of wholeness and completeness. A white heron flies by. By the way, there was a white heron where I am, and in Zen, a white heron is a consider because a white heron is a revered animal because it's a lot around rice paddies, right? And it helps continue the growth of the plant. So I know every time I say white, I pause, but this is part of the culture here. A white heron flies by. Stillness. Then we go back to the beginning here of the chapter. Last week, one of the Sunday school children saw me sitting zazen, and she said, "I can do it." She crossed her legs and said, "Now what? Now what?" I was very interested in her question because many of you have the same question. You come here every day to practice Zen, and you ask me, "Now what? Now what?" I don't think I can fully explain this point. It's not a question that can be answered. You should know for yourself. We sit in a formal posture so we can experience something through our bodies, not by my teaching, but by your own physical practice. However, to be able to sit in a particular way and to attain a particular state of mind is not perfect study. After you have full experience of mind and body, you will be able to express it in other ways as well. Without sticking to formal posture, you naturally convey your mind to others in various ways. You will have the same state of mind sitting in a chair or standing, working or speaking. It is the state of mind in which you do not stick to anything. This is the purpose of a practice. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.